Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy Crane. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and this is the 100th episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy. And starting on September 8th, I'll be offering an intermediate Art of Slow Comedy class where we'll be focusing on two-person scenes, doing good two-person scenes. You can't do good long form unless you have the foundation, which is doing great two-person scenes. My classes are all limited to 12 people, so you get plenty of stage time and personal attention, and you get those reps that make you an even better improviser. For more information on my award-winning Art of Slow Comedy classes, go to jimmycrane.com. We're also brought to you by the good people at Hotel Lincoln. So the next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago and you're looking for a cool boutique hotel that's close to everything, it's not only pet friendly, but it's also improviser friendly as well, check out the official hotel of Improv Nerd, the Hotel Lincoln. We have a great show for you today. Our guest today was a writer for Conan for 17 years, and we were lucky enough to get him as he was coming into Chicago for the I.O. grand opening, where he was doing his one-man show, the Brian McCann Leisure Hour. Our guest today is none other than Brian McCann. Now, you know him from the Conan O'Brien show and the many hilarious characters he did on that show. But Brian started here in Chicago, and I actually was a roommate with him, with another friend of ours, Pat Finn. So we talked about how he started in improv and how he transitioned into stand-up and how he got the job at Conan O'Brien and his relationship with Conan O'Brien. We also talked to him about going back recently and improvising at the UCB and what that experience was like for him, and then taking a year off to develop this show, the Brian McCann Leisure Hour. I've always had a lot of respect for Brian. He is a guy that is just, he's self-motivated, and he teaches himself to do stuff, and he doesn't get intimidated by things. I think you are going to love this episode. It is chock full of wonderful stories, but more importantly than that, some really great practical advice from Brian McCann. I really enjoyed this, and it was great reconnecting with him after all these years. Just a quick note before we get to this episode, it's not our typical live show, so there is no improv here. It's just a straight-on interview for about an hour plus. So just wanted to make you aware of that. Before we get to the interview with Brian, I just want to say thank you, everyone, for helping me get to this 100th episode. It is a milestone. It is a really, really, really big deal. And there's a little shame. No, there's a lot of shame in me that, you know what, I should have made a bigger deal out of this, and I didn't. I've just been, there's a lot going on in my life. I've been traveling a lot more because of this podcast. I've been teaching a lot more because of this podcast. My wife, Lauren, and I, we are trying to have a baby. As you know, I'm 50 years old, and my sperm, the last time we checked it, was improving, but I had some abnormal sperm, so it made it a little difficult to get a baby. Not like I'm going to go to a store and buy it, but you know, you go to a fertility doctor, and you know, I'm taking some CoQ10 or something like that, and not taking hot baths, and staying out of the steam room and the sauna at the health club, and trying not to have the computer on my lap. So, and we're also, I mean, you know, having a baby is a big deal, but a bigger deal in my life is, we're trying to get a couch for our house, and we have very specific measurements to get it up the stairs. So I'm more focused, of course, on the couch than a baby, but you would expect that from me. And I quickly want to thank Stage 773 here in Chicago for giving us such a beautiful home. I'd also like to thank our original producer who helped get this show off the ground, Ben Caprero. I'd like to thank Dan Schiffmacher, who's done a wonderful job with heading up all the videos that we put up on YouTube. And I'd like to thank Dustin and Stig over at Feral Audio. It is so great to be part of feralaudio.com and that podcast collective. And most importantly, I'd like to thank my wife, Lauren Corain, who helps me in so many ways. She does the PR, she does the marketing, she edits the blog, she helps me come up with questions to ask the guests on Improv Nerd. She makes sure I have clean clothes when I travel and teach and do Improv Nerds out of town. And most importantly, she puts up with me. So I want to thank her. Here you go. Here's the Brian McCann episode. I know you're going to love it.
Jimmy's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
It's great to see you again.
It's good to see you.
Former roommate.
Yes, former. You know, and I was not a good roommate. And I just want to make an amends to you.
I was awful. What were your sins?
My sins were I think I was jealous of you. I think I was very passive aggressive when you had your girlfriend there. One time I went into your bedroom, you know, when you weren't there.
Okay.
So those are.
Did you do something?
I didn't do anything. No.
Okay, you just stood there.
Yeah. Well, I looked around.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I forgive you.
Well, thank you.
I hope you forgive me.
I totally forgive you. I'm glad we got that. Because I felt bad about it. I honestly did, you know?
I've never once considered you at all a bad roommate.
Okay.
I considered that to be a pretty dark period in my life.
In what way?
Real lack of respect for life and property fueled by alcohol.
There was an incident, and I don't know if you remember this. Let's make sure this is... Yes, this is going.
Yeah, make sure this is recording.
Yes, yes. Where there was a couple of friends of yours would come into town. Names aren't important.
Yeah, I know.
But it was almost like that episode of the Bob Newhart Show when the peeper would come and all hell would break loose. And I remember one morning getting up and literally... Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
Can you fill it in?
I would say if it's the same morning... All the furniture had been thrown, literally thrown, into one corner of the apartment. I think there may have been urine on the floor. It was as trashed as an apartment can be and still be stained.
It looked like a tornado had hit. It was unbelievable. How did you get interested in improv?
You know, this is what happened. All through my childhood, but then through college, I wanted to be a comic strip artist slash Berkeley Breathed or Charles Schultz. I wanted to have a comic strip. And in college, I had one in the newspaper. I went to Boston College, and my comic strip was BC50. And it was, you know, making fun of the campus police. And so after graduation, I moved back from Boston... And set myself up for whatever reason with an apartment in Evanston.
I remember it.
Because I thought, well, you know, that would be a nice quiet place, but close to the city, because I got a job at Sears doing copywriting and ad layout. But I thought, that'd be a nice quiet place, I won't be distracted, and I can really perfect my comic strip. And so I would spend nights and days and all free time up there creating my comic strip and writing it, and I just realized I couldn't write 4-panel humor consistently. Like, if I had an inspired idea, then great, but I didn't have the muscle to consistently, day after day, find something funny and concisely present it. And so I thought, well, I should go take some, like, comedy classes in Chicago and just, you know, like, work on these muscles. Like, in college I took writing and film and all that kind of stuff, but I thought a real focus on comedy classes would help me. And so that's when I started with the Improv Olympic, and then from there I was like, oh, I'm funnier on stage than I am on paper. And then from doing improv, people encouraged me to try stand-up because I was always writing, and writing and improv don't always coincide. Those two worlds don't always work well. I mean, there's usually improv groups are trying to do sketch shows, but this was before I was welcomed into a group that wanted to do a sketch show with me, and so like that's how I also branched into stand-up. But it was all still an attempt to learn how to really write concisely.
So let's back up for just a second. You studied at the IO, and you were on Fish Stick.
That was my first team, yeah.
And it had Chris Farley, Ian Gomez, Pat Finn. Is there a memory you have from that team? Because it was a great team.
Well, any memory I have really from that team is just going to be being incredibly impressed by Farley.
Mm-hmm. And what impressed you about him?
Just the typical thing you would hear about Chris Farley if you read a book or whatever. But it was literally, it's just his raw energy and charisma and willingness. Or I don't even know if it was willingness. It was just his ability to just not care about anything. He had no self-respect in a way. It was just anything for a laugh. And that, to me, was probably like the greatest lesson of just sacrifice everything and get your laugh.
But what's interesting to me in the wake of Robin Williams' death,
mm-hmm.
I remember running into Farley because, you know, Fish Stick and Tequila Mockingbird, you know, we would perform on the same
night.
We
were 1-2 punch.
1-2 punch.
Yeah.
You guys were a little more potent than we were, but...
you were a little more cerebral.
Yes, way more cerebral. But I remember running into him, and it's like you never got a sense of who he was.
True.
And you work with him more than a lot of people. Did you ever get a sense who he truly was?
No, never. And he would surprise me. He actually ended up living with Pat Finn and myself for maybe 2 weeks when our other roommate, Jim Conroy, went out of town. I remember Jim Conroy coming back after 2 weeks, and he's like, "You let Farley sleep in my bed. I can smell it." And he was so pissed. And he was right. Like, you know, we were guilty. No, and I never did. And Farley would surprise me because he was a guy that went to church frequently. And, like, he had another side to him that... I guess he kept secret, or at least I was unaware of. And then he also had friends that weren't quite in the improv world. I don't know, like old friends from college that I think perhaps knew him on a different level, because I would see him with these other people and it would look like they were actually having normal conversations as opposed to constantly doing bits for each other.
Mm-hmm.
But my relationship, and I think most people's relationship with Farley, never really got beyond constantly doing bits or just imbibing copious amounts of old style.
Mm-hmm. And then you were on a group which I performed with you, the Comedy Underground, which had Andy Richter, yeah. Dave Koechner, Brian Stack, Kevin Dorr. And when you look back, it's like half the staff at one time of Conan.
Yeah.
How important were those relationships to land your job at Conan?
Well, in truth, I mean, the only one that was at all important in landing the job at Conan was Andy, because Andy was a fan of my style, I guess, or whatever, and he would always let me know when Conan was looking for writers. Like, mm-hmm. you know, he'd say, there's a position opening up. But that was the extent of what he could do, because he didn't have the power to just say, hire this guy. Like, he tried that, but I had to submit three separate times. And I even, like, Conan initially came through town with Robert Smigel before the show even started, and they were looking for writers, and they came and saw me do stand-up and liked me, and we talked afterwards. But at that time, they didn't feel I was a right fit. But by the third time I submitted, which was probably almost a year and a half into the show, I think I had a better sense of what they were looking for, and they had a better sense of that I could consistently present new ideas to them. Like, I wasn't just a guy who was presenting the same ideas over and over with each packet. Like, I really tried to show them new, different...
So you weren't just submitting the same packet over and over again?
No, and on my third time I submitted, you know, a packet of new ideas, and then I started faxing in a page of ideas each day to them. Like, until I heard no, I was just like, all right, well, I'm going to keep...
Where did you get that drive? Where did you get that idea to do that? That it's really tenacity, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I don't know exactly where I got that. I think I bought into, and maybe like from my mother as a kid, but you know, like, there's the boys that go out and play, and then there's the boys that stay in and work hard. And if you sacrifice going out and playing to work hard, those are the boys, you know, that get ahead or whatever. And I think whatever day she fed me that lesson just sort of stuck. And maybe it was because no one wanted to play with me as a kid or whatever. But
is that true?
That no one wanted to play with me as a kid? Yeah, I do remember going... Like, my sisters were popular, and I remember them always having friends over at the house. And then their friends, my sister's friends, would be like, well, you should go. You know, my brother's not doing anything. Just go over to, you know, see Kevin. And I remember just, like, so nerdily, like, going over to, like, these guys' house, like... Your sister said maybe we should play. And the guys, like, then I'd be ditched. And stuff like that. I didn't really start hanging out with people probably until, like, freshman year of high school. And it wasn't until junior year of high school that I started hanging out with people that I wanted to hang out with. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And how... And there was always, like... You mentioned your mom, but there was always, like, with your dad, that he was very... I always got the sense that you thought he was very square. Is that a fair assessment?
That is, yeah, a pretty fair assessment. He was very, he still is, rigidly Catholic, which was just never, even as a kid, I just never bought into that world. And so, I guess square is the right word. It was just, he was just very predictably Catholic, very consistent with that. And I was always... I don't know. My brain was always, like, questioning and...
Did you get in trouble as a kid because of the questioning?
With my father, possibly, but not in general. I wasn't... I was... Well, up until sixth grade, I was a pretty bad student, and my parents were cautioned that junior high and high school were going to be real trying times, and I think they thought, like, I was going to be... someone that the police were going to be bringing home and stuff. But, like, I turned it on in seventh grade. Like, everybody was stunned. I wasn't, but, like, I became, like, a straight-A student in seventh grade. And I don't know what that was from. I think it was just... I think I was kind of bored, like, first grade through sixth grade. I'm not saying, like, I was too smart for it or anything. I just think, like... The lessons were pretty slow and, like, you could grasp it. And then, like, I always enjoyed finishing whatever work needed to be done and then screwing around. I've always enjoyed screwing around.
Well, and part of that is your style. I mean, even when you're on stage and you do your stand-up, there's an element of, like, I'm playing around, I'm screwing around, we're kind of all joking together.
Yeah.
Can you describe your style?
Well, I can describe it this way, in that there's no doubt that the strongest influence on me as a stand-up would have been Steve Martin, his first album in particular, where it was, like, the way I approach stand-up, like a sketch show, in that I want to present multiple different viewpoints and ideas and, like, either talents or just worlds, as opposed to a stand-up that comes out there and just, like, I'm the guy that hates the government, you know, and then just has an hour thesis that's really, you know, thoughtful and entertaining about why the government's bad and why we gotta get together. And, like, I prefer to, like, I prefer to have like a little bit about poetry, and then like maybe something about country music, and then maybe a tap dance routine, you know, and then maybe a psychic episode. And I like just doing, it's basically a one-man sketch show.
But it's also like almost anti-comedy. Now, you were telling me earlier about this, the poetry thing.
Right.
Can you describe that? This is in your Brian McCann leisure hour.
Yeah, in a nutshell, this is very anti-comedy. It's I talk about poetry, and I somewhat belittle the audience, you know, into thinking like they're a bunch of Philistines and I'm a little fancier than they are. And I introduce my favorite poem, and I say, like, and if you don't mind, I'd like to read it right now. And then I open a book, and I silently read it. And it's one of those things, like, it just takes the audience a second to be like, to get, just, the joke is just, he said he wants to read it, and he's reading it, and he's not going to read it out loud to us.
But really, if you, that to me is like, you know, how many times have we seen a stand-up go out there and go, I'm going to read you a poem, and then they read, like, a funny poem.
Right.
You know, so to me, you're like, it's almost like making fun of those people as well.
It is a little bit, but to me, it's just the way I like to do stuff. I will also, I'm as guilty as anybody of also doing a funny poem. Like, I do in my current show, like, songs, and those, a song is really nothing more than a funny poem, sort of. If
yeah,
right. I mean, if it's funny,
right,
and if it rhymes,
right. And where did you develop that? Because I remember when we were starting out together, you were doing a little music stuff, but you did you have experience as a musician at that point?
No, I. I've always been drawn to it. I was one of those like guys who wanted to be a guitar player. I always had a guitar, knew minimal ways to fake myself through some songs or whatever. But I would say in the last, you know, 15 years, I've delved into it, and it's become, you know, like I there was probably 15 years there where I played at least a couple hours a day. And, you know, took a few lessons and then really studied it. I tried to study music theory, but that didn't click.
The thing that I always liked about you and I understood was you would, if you there was a part of you that could be self-taught. Like stand-up, you didn't take any stand-up class. You
no.
Just, okay, I'm going to do it. From an improv background. And the music was kind of the same thing.
Right.
You know? How has that helped you?
I don't know, like, how that helps me. I mean, I guess it certainly helps in developing your own unique style. Like, I did that artistically, too, like, cartooning. I mean, I guess I saw that I had some sort of talent, or, like, initially as a kid, I was like, oh, I can draw Charlie Brown exactly like Charlie Brown looks like, and I can draw, if you remember, Hagar the Horrible.
Sure.
I was a kid who was able to recreate any cartoon pretty spot on. And then I don't know, maybe just from that experience, just like, oh, what else can I do? And I think I've always had this unjustified suspicion of teachers, in a way. Like, I remember as a kid, my dad did set up for me banjo lessons, and I always felt like the banjo teacher was so condescending and talking down to me, and like it was much more comfortable for me, and maybe it was because I was self-conscious about my lack of skill or whatever, but it was much more comfortable for me to be like, no, just let me, like, you show me that and then just let me go work on it. Like, don't sit there and challenge me to do it right now and criticize me. Like, I see what you're doing. If I can go work on that for 5 hours, I can do it as good as you.
Do you like to work alone, like even when you're with Conan?
Yes.
Do you prefer that?
I do, and that's not a good quality. And I've changed, like, through hard work of my own, like...
When you mean hard work of your own, what do you mean?
Like, really, you know, like, you tell yourself, like, I should not do this alone. Like someone has offered to work with me, and I used to be like, no, I got it. And it was initially a tough choice for me to be like, okay, yeah, let's work together. And then because I had spent my entire life sort of working alone, and I mean, cartooning especially is such a solo, silent sort of pastime. It took me a long time. Like, in improv, you instantly recognize, like, oh, we all need to be here, and we all have an equal part in the success of this group mind beast that is happening. But in writing, I always have, like, in my head, like, a solid idea of what I want, and it was very hard for me to learn to let go of my single-minded notion and to accept that, oh, so-and-so's contribution is far superior to anything I was ever going to come up with. And to accept that and to embrace it just took a while. I mean, it's, I guess, a form of therapy.
Did it come by a therapist? Did a therapist?
No, I never felt I had enough cash to... A therapy always seemed like such a luxury to me, and I never felt flush enough to...
Even when you were making a lot of money at Conan?
Yeah, because that money was all going places. I have yet to feel like I'm a...
Because I would imagine, especially when you got to NBC, The Tonight Show, and you had been there for a long time, I mean, it was probably money beyond what you ever thought.
Yeah, it was good money. However, The Tonight Show took me away from New York, and so I still had my house in New York, and now I had to have a place in L.A., and granted, it wasn't a great place, but I was paying two rents or mortgages, and I was also paying to fly back and forth every weekend. There was an enormous suck on that money. Nowhere in there, like, once I had the two apartments and constant flying, a bell didn't click off in my head. Now I can afford therapy.
Well, that's... I think that's very interesting because, again, it goes back to this thing of, like, self-taught. You saw it was an obstacle, and then you were willing to work on it. The hey, I'm not working... I don't work well with others. I need to do that. Let's talk about Conan for a second.
Yeah.
Some of the characters that you did. How did improv help develop those characters?
It was 100% the key element in developing those characters, because most of those characters came out of just screwing around in the room, the writer's room. Like, there's nothing I enjoy more doing than just, like, wasting time and just coming up with bits and trying to entertain people. Or just, you know, like, throw something on my head.
Who do you think enjoys it more, you or Conan? Because when I saw Conan, that guy is like, he's a bit machine.
He is, you know, an incredible bit machine. There's no better bit machine. But he wasn't in the room too much. But when he came into the room, like, everyone has to stand aside because he's an incredible bit machine. And in a world... the most impressive world of knowledge that he can draw from, a photographic memory. Like, I think he's remembered literally, like, every single show he's ever watched in his life, like, down to edits. Like,
what was your relationship with him? Because you worked for him for 17 years.
It never got to a real friendly... He always had walls. Like, there was never, like, hey, let's go grab coffee, or, like, let's do this. Or if it ever was just him and me, like, driving in a car, it would feel awkward, you know, like, there wouldn't be that just, hey, it's just two buddies driving.
Have you ever had a Christmas party at his house or anything?
Oh, yeah.
But it was always, like, kind of...
But you'd go there and, you know, and there'd be Kevin Sorbo there, you know, or whoever.
Who's Kevin Sorbo?
I don't know, didn't he play Tarzan?
Yeah. I don't even know.
But, you know, they're, like, at a Conan Christmas party, it's not just him and the writers, you know, exchanging gifts. It's a fairly high-profile thing, like with NBC executives, and everybody's got to somewhat be on their best behavior.
So you couldn't get too drunk.
Well, you did get too drunk, but then Conan would, you know, He had a eloquent way of getting us, you know, the drunk writers and the drunk writers' wives to move away from the executives.
Are you serious?
Yeah, he's a very smart. Conan's a very smart, savvy. Like, he's a great writer. He's a great bit machine, but he's also a savvy player of the, you know, the executive game.
Someone once told me that he is the most. He is incredibly driven.
He is definitely incredibly driven.
You know,
he is more so. I mean, more so than I'm a self-starter. Like, he and I are very similar. Like, which is maybe why we never clicked on like such a personal level, because we have a lot of similar qualities, which is we felt ostracized as children and felt compelled to show our childhood bullies that we were something.
Is that really your motivation in comedy?
I don't know, but I'm just, you know, as a psychological, like a therapy point of view,
right,
kind of thing. Like, where does
that
drive come from?
Did you feel like you were bullied as a kid?
I was absolutely bullied as a kid.
Like, give me an example of how people bullied you.
There was a certain group of kids from the grade above me that constantly liked to just whoop my ass. Like,
physically?
Oh, yeah.
Out in Wheaton, which is out in super Christian, you know.
Yeah, it's not as Christian as, you know.
It's advertised.
Don't just believe what you see in Wikipedia.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I was... There's always some element throughout my life. I tell my daughter this, like, there's always been something about my face that either people like or it instantly instills hate and the desire to just pummel me. And I there was definite people in Wheaton. It was Billy Hedberg and his gang of ne'er-do-wells. And they would always... It was like daily almost. Like, there he is! Like, I was such a pansy that I'd be like, ah, here they come. And I think they enjoyed the fact that I ran and hid from them, and then if they found me, they'd punch me and just call me, like, you know, mean names.
And when did you feel like...
Your podcast is rated.
Right, right. You can say whatever you want. When did you feel like in your career, like, I got back at those guys?
There's an exact point.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, through doing improv and stand-up in Chicago... All those days long forgotten, you know, like they aren't like fresh sores that stayed in my psyche. I start, this relationship blossoms between me and Kevin Matthews from The Loop.
And Kevin Matthews, if people don't know, was a really funny.
So funny.
Radio personality. He was big in Chicago.
Very big. He was like the afternoon drive time guy on The Loop, which at the time was the biggest radio station. And when he came to town, he and I started doing stand-up together, like, right away, and he brought me into his show as a character, or multiple characters, and it just was super nice to me and everything. And he had just, like, this drive and this machine behind him, so there was the Kevin Matthews, you know, like, there was beach parties and barbecues, and they'd be attended by 1,000 people, and then he had, like, his own golf outing, the Will Shorts golf outing.
Which was a character. Jim Shorts.
Yeah, Jim Shorts.
Which is a character.
Right, not Will Shorts. Jim Shorts. And so it was a Jim Shorts golf outing, and people would pay a lot of money to be teamed up with their, like, it'd be a threesome, would pay a lot of money, and then a celebrity, you know, of any...
Like a local Chicago celebrity. Mike Ditka or someone.
Yeah, or you might get Walter Payton. You don't know who you're going to get.
Right.
And so I was in his celebrity golf outing, and the threesome I got paired with, the guys who paid, were my high school bullies.
And you were the celebrity?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And it was great. And in a classic form, they were completely happy. They were like, oh, yeah, and had no memory. Like, to me, like, the traumatic memories were vivid, and to them, I think they're abusing me or bullying me didn't register on them at all. Like, I don't think they had any recollection of it.
What was going on in your head when this happened?
I was just laughing. I wanted to get to a phone. It was before he could text, but I was calling like high school friends. Like, you'll never guess who, like, who has each paid $400 to golf with me. And it was great. It was a perfect, you know, conclusion to that whole saga. But it turned out there wasn't a saga. That saga just existed for me.
Because I would have probably been still terrified. You know, I would have been like, oh, they're paying $400 to beat the shit out of me, you know?
It was total happenstance that I got grouped with them. Like, they didn't ask, you know. It was just like, it was an amazing bit of serendipity. And it taught me the lesson that what you think exists in your mind doesn't exist in your mind. You know, usually you exaggerate and you over-personalize someone's words to you or actions towards you. And granted, these guys used to chase me and beat me up and stuff like that. One of them punched my two front teeth out as a kid. Luckily, they were...
What did your parents say to that? Did you share it with them that was happening? Or did
yes,
you...
I ran home holding my teeth and bleeding.
And what did your mom and dad say?
Nothing, really. They were like, well, you know, like... And then, like, we had a school function 2 days later, and I was like, that's the kid. And I pointed, like, to my dad. I'm like, that's the kid. And I expected my dad to go beat the crap out of him. And he's like, well, you know, turn the other cheek. And I was like, really? Turn the other cheek. I remember taking karate classes. Like, that was my answer. I was like, well, I'm going to take karate classes, and I'll do my own McCann justice on these guys.
Well, was there a sense, and I don't want to get too psychological, like my, and this is true in my life, so I don't want to, I'm probably projecting it onto you, like, my dad's not taking care of me, so I've got to do karate, I've got to develop this skill as comedy, because nobody's sticking up for me.
Yeah, no one did stick up for me.
You know?
So maybe, I mean, this is very deep, this is free therapy, finally. I can afford free therapy.
Yes, that's great.
Yeah, that's possibly, those are all possibly the motivators that have gotten me where I'm at. Who knows, man? This human animal is such a complicated
mystery. It is. So what were some of your favorite characters that you did on Conan? There was a talk show guy that you had said that you really liked doing.
I really did enjoy it. Jerry Butters.
Okay.
And Jerry Butters had the show across the hall from Conan. And he was on at 4 a.m. And I would always come over, you know, I had horrible brown 70s suits and my hair just kind of like slicked down, just all bad taste. And I would come over during my commercial breaks, theoretically, and just sort of interrupt Conan and just sort of talk to Conan and try to commiserate about how hard it is to have a talk show. And his talk show would be going great. And I'd be like, who do you got tonight? You know, and he'd be like, oh, you know, we got Ted Danson. I'd be like, oh, that must be nice. Yeah, I got Abe Vigoda again. We're doing Abe Vigoda week. It's my fourth night in a row with Abe Vigoda. It's nothing but good burger stories. I enjoyed doing that.
Why do you enjoy doing that character?
It's just, to me, that just the idea. It was kind of like the... I felt like the neighbor on a sitcom, sort of, like was it, who was Bob Newhart's, was it Jerry?
No,
well?
Jerry was the pharmacist, the character, the actor was Bill Daly.
Yeah.
I can't think of the guy's name now.
Me either. But it really felt to me like I was getting a chance to do that kind of character, just the guy kind of coming over and just interrupting and having nothing to offer. Like, I used to always compare monologues with Conan as Jerry Butters, and I'd be like, hey, Conan, do you do any jokes about Bill Clinton tonight? And he'd be like, yeah, like I said this joke. I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's funny. I told some Bill Clinton jokes, too. You know, but I would never say what they were and be like, oh, boy, I really gave it to the Olympics tonight, Conan. man.
And you also warmed up the audience, didn't you?
Yeah, that was the funnest part of the day. I did that for 8 years.
And what was so fun about it? Just performing?
Yeah, it was a chance to, because, you know, you're writing for a show, but it's still, you're in an office and you have a structure every day. And just to be given this, like, window at 5 o'clock every day, just, okay, now your office life is done for 30 minutes because you're going to go down and get to just go do stand-up and crowd work and improvise with the audience and just have fun.
And did you prepare anything, or did you, was it just...
You have to, as a warm-up guy, you have to have... You have a responsibility. I learned this the hard way. I got to... Early on, I was invited to do stand-up at the... There was this HBO Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen.
Mm-hmm. Which at one time was like the premier...
The premier thing.
Yeah.
And so I was there for the inaugural year. And I was doing stand-up, and I caught the eye of some people, and I ended up...
Caught the eye meaning?
Like, they were like, hey, here's a funny, fresh face or whatever. And all of a sudden, like, just for this week in Aspen, I was invited to partake in, you know, other shows. Like, I was booked there for a week, but just doing 2 10-minute sets. But that week turned into, like, 3 shows a night, but, like, just little, like, 15-minute parts on other shows or whatever. But at the end of the week was Gary Shandling's Young Comedian special live from the Aspen Cool Building.
And when you went, you weren't supposed to be in that.
No, and I wasn't, but I got picked to be the warm-up guy for that special. And I had no experience doing it. And so they tape... Well, there's 2 specials. So there's the practice special, and then there's the live special. And so for the practice special, I go out there and I do the warm-up, and I just do my stand-up. And it was a complete shock to me. Like, I go out there to do warm-up, or just my stand-up, and just the audience is filing in and milling around and no one's paying attention. And I was just like, oh, like, and I'm just doing my jokes and bits and like little skits, one-man skits or whatever. And I come back stage and Gary Shandling goes out, and then he comes back and he goes, who the fuck warmed up this crowd? It's fucking death out there. And I was just, I sat silently, and this guy, Jeff Cesario, who was the one who picked me to be the warm-up guy, it was the classiest thing I ever saw. Like, he goes up and just puts his arm around Gary Shandling, and he goes, it's a new guy, I'm going to go talk to him right now, he's great. He goes, don't worry about it, we're going to send so-and-so out there right now, I'm going to talk to the warm-up guy. And then Jeff Cesario sits me down and just gives me this very quick tutorial on warm-up. He's like, you're not there to do stand-up. You're there to make the audience excited that they're at a TV show. You're there to explain, like, look at these lights, and you're not going to see the director, but you're going to hear him, and he's in a truck back there, and you have to, like, bring them in on this atmosphere of what is taking place, and, you know, you really have to set the stage and the mood for them to be there, and you have to, like, encourage them to, as hokey as it sounds, like, to applaud and just to be peppy.
You're a cheerleader.
You are. You're a cheerleader and a coach. And it was so foreign to me, but it all made sense. I was like, oh, okay. And so, like, miraculously, he didn't replace me for the actual live Gary Shandling Young Comedian
special. Did you think he was going to when you saw
it? He should have.
Right.
He should have. Right. I mean, anybody else there could have done it. But...
And did you want to just slink away in shame?
I felt awful. I was horrified. I was so frightened. But I go out there and I basically just do the Jeff Cesario tutorial of how to warm up a crowd. And I was comfortable in it. Like, I wasn't just a deer in headlights. Like, people were milling around and I was just like, sit down! Like, you know, like, I understood my role as opposed to just going out there and not understanding my role. And so I took that with me to Conan. And so,
and did that go well, would you say?
Yes.
Okay.
Much
great.
Better.
Okay.
Much better. Everybody
Gary
was happy.
Shandling didn't come back.
Gary Shandling was happy. The show went great. It was the introduction of Dave Chappelle to most people.
Did Gary Shandling ever... Did you ever run into Gary Shandling after that?
Never did.
He never showed up on Conan?
I not that I know of.
Okay.
I have always idolized him.
Yeah.
Never met him. I don't even think I met him that night. I was hiding.
Was that hard for you when he was that? Because he was someone you idolized. You're like, oh god,
yeah.
It's bad enough that I.
To know you've let someone down is bad enough, but to hear them just be like, who the fuck did this? And you know, you're the one, and it's just like, oh, I'm so sorry. You're like one of my 3 comedy idols.
Who are the other 2?
me.
Okay.
No. You know, back then it would definitely be Gary Shandling. Steve Martin's always been up there. You know, Bill Hicks, you got to throw his name.
I'll never forget a night that you took us out to, you were working at the Funny Firm.
Right.
And I think you got like me and Koechner, and there was a
because you guys weren't going to see stand-ups. Oh, no, because you guys were anti-stand-up.
People don't understand this. Just tell them this, because I say this on this podcast all the time. But when people were in improv, there was a...
There was a real snub your nose at stand-up. Like,
and where do you think that came from?
It all comes from insecurity. It all comes from seeing a stand-up. Because this is... People looked down on stand-up because it's like... he's just doing the same thing over and over again. You know, he's saying the same things over and over again. He's acting as if that's an original thought. Where meanwhile, you would go do improv, and we were all doing the same things over and over again, or the same characters, and, you know, more or less trying to make it seem fresh and, like, off the cuff sort of thing.
And you, it was interesting because you, like, broke away pretty quickly. And back then, that was like a huge thing. And I remember you would call Sharna up and say, "Hey, Sharna, I got this bit. I want to do it. Can I come to open up for whatever show?"
Yeah.
I mean, you were just like, you were just blazing a trail wherever you could do it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So I took you guys, yeah. And so I really wanted to show you guys, like, stand-up is not all just hacky crap. Like, there's brilliant guys out there. And so, yeah, I was...
Do you remember this?
Tell us. Well, because I was working this week at the Funny Firm, and I had seen many great stand-ups coming through. Like, I really enjoy a stand-up, and I can watch the same act over and over and really start appreciating, like, how someone continually makes it appear fresh and all that. And then, all of a sudden, Bill Hicks comes into town, and I had never seen Bill Hicks, and I'd always heard about Bill Hicks. And his style and energy and focus and just commitment to
his... And his raw anger.
Yeah, his raw anger. I was just like, these guys, Jimmy, Koechner, they have to see this. Because you two, to me, were like the strongest holdouts of anti-stand-up.
I feel so much shame about that.
And I remember like bringing you in, and I was like...
It was like a Sunday. It was a Sunday, and it was really cold and really snowy.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was the late or early show, if they only had one show, but it wasn't that filled as
right.
I remember.
It was not that filled.
And so pick it up from there.
And I don't know, it wasn't quite kicking and screaming that you guys went, but I know it was just like, oh, all right. But I think you trusted my...
Yeah, yes.
My thing of just like, this guy, like, you guys are really going to love him. And I just remember both of your eyes just, like, expanding, like, beyond anything I'd ever seen, and just your minds being blown by just the mastery and just, like, everything we just said, the energy.
Well, he had done that bit about Jay Leno. That night, you know, like, he's the devil and stuff like that. And I just remember being like, who talks like this? I mean, it's like, nobody talked like that. You know, like, you don't ever talk about icons like that.
Right.
And he talked about it with so much anger and so much, I mean, he was brilliant. And the thing about him is, I don't think he would have, I don't know where he would have fit in today, you know, because he had... He wasn't, like, TV friendly. He was
very opposed to it. He, you know, he openly mocked any stand-up that ever sold out, like, to sell any product. Like, he would certainly not exist today, because now there's not even a shame in selling out. Like,
right.
It's like, oh, you don't endorse a phone company? Like, you suck, you know? Like, it's such a different world just from 20 years ago.
But I don't know what they would have done with that anger. I mean, it was so, like, palpable. You know?
There's a place. There's so many outlets. There's so many channels now. He would have been given opportunities. He was also beloved in England, and I think he loved being over there as well. He, you know, like, he was the crazy, wild, smart, angry American during very volatile political times.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he wasn't really political, he was just spot-on character assassination.
We got off. Let's get back. So then you do the you learn at Aspen, and now you're going back to Conan for the warm up.
So what I learned, my warm up at Conan was always probably 3 to 5 minutes up top of just welcoming the audience and sort of setting the stage. You know, I would have like some like standard jokes that I would work in there. And then there was a stage manager who would catch my eye, and then he would sort of flash me how many fingers, like say, like he'd go 20, and I would know I would have to fill 20 minutes. And so I would do my like 5 minutes of like, welcoming, and here's the show, and this is the stage, and Conan. I would always say, Conan's backstage doing coke. He's so excited for you guys. You know, like that was always one of my standard jokes. And then it just, the only way to deal with an audience like that at that point is you start crowd work and just talking to people and finding out.
You're improvising.
Yeah,
right?
And then you improvise. And it's the funnest thing in the world to me to, you start conversations with people and you make patterns with like this person from Virginia and this crazy guy from England. And, you know, and like my goal was always to bring the audience together. Like I kept showing them, I kept like it was a mantra kind of thing. Like, see, we're all one big team here. Like you're from England and you're from Japan, but look, we're getting together. And like, you two, why don't you hug? You know, like that kind of thing. Just anything. Like my whole goal was to create an audience that felt comfortable with each other. I thought that was the most important thing. So that by the time Conan came out there, everyone was comfortable enough to laugh in front of each other. Because a lot of times, an audience is a fragmented group of people, and even if they find something funny, they're not going to laugh as if they're just with their own group laughing. And so to me, it was a top priority to make that group as cohesive and comfortable as possible.
So they could all laugh together.
Yes.
How did you get that job? Because when I saw it, it was probably the first year you were there, so that's 16 years ago. Conan actually opened up the show.
Yeah, and he continued to do that until he got the Tonight Show. I would go out, and then the band would play, and then after the band would play, Conan would come out
right.
And do like an Elvis medley or something. Uh-huh. But the way I got the job was this guy Mike Sweeney, incredibly funny guy, was doing it for the first 6 years or whatever, and then he got hired as head writer. And so he could no longer do it as head writer, and he just suggested that I do it. God bless him.
Now, do you get extra for that money-wise?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Because I've always heard those are good-paying jobs.
You don't get that kind of money because you work there. But it was like an extra $800 a week, which is an extra $800 a week.
And then you love doing it.
I absolutely loved it.
And now you tell me you're in Chicago now as we're doing this interview because you're doing a one-person show called the Brian McCann Leisure Hour.
Exactly.
And you were telling me before that you had gotten back to improvising since you've moved to New York.
Right, yeah. I'm back in New York full-time, and yeah, that was one of the first things I wanted to do is just get back on stage. Because all of my time at Conan, like, you're working 12-hour days. It's really as simple as it seems, like if you just think like, oh, and then it would be fun on weekends to improvise. Like you're so burnt by the end of the week, like the last thing you want to do is sit around and do more comedy stuff, because that's what you're doing all week long. And so I did very little improv while I was working at Conan, but it was the first thing I jumped back into once I left and found myself with free time.
And what was that like going back? You broke into UCB. What was that first night back?
The first night was hilarious because...
And you're doing ASCAT, right?
Yeah, the ASCAT show on Sunday. And I'm like... I had been out of the scene for so long and off of a lot of like young comedy fans' radar. And so I go to ASCAT and they stop me at the door. And I go, yeah, I'm doing the show tonight. And the girl just looks at me, and she goes, okay. She goes, are you doing the monologues? And I go, no, I'm going to improvise. And she goes, you are. And she's just, like, staring at me, and I just go, what do you think of that? And she goes, okay. And then she just lets me in, and it was just a very humbling, like...
Well, how did you get the chance to do it? Because it's very hard to break into the UCB, either New York or L.A.,
Well, my one-man show, Brian McCann's Leisure Hour, is being directed by Michael Delaney, who is in charge of the entire sketch writing department at UCB. So through him and I working together, we would talk. We meet together once a week and I perform for him, what I think the show is now. And just through those days, we would talk about, the shows. And he was like, well, you'd be welcome at ASCAT any time. So, he's the one who said to me, you'd be welcome.
See, the difference between you and me, you hear that and you're like, I'm going to show up next Sunday. Me, I'm like, oh, do they really want me? Did he really mean that,
I didn't think they wanted
you. You never question that, do you?
I do. I always question it, but I always force myself to...
So you're going
to
show up even being insecure?
I completely did.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I would leave doing ASCAT completely convinced that no one was happy I was there. But going, I'm going to go there next week, though. Because, there is a storyline that I'm trying to write for myself currently, which is I'm trying to get back. I have this weird goal I've set for myself, which I want to do a one man show that's a interesting, viable one man show that young and old alike want to come see.
Can we say commercial hit?
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. That would be the greatest thing. And no one has asked me to do this show. It's literally just me just going, that would be fun. And that's a challenge. Because I know, I have credits, and I know I have a history, but I still cannot... I can't walk into a comedy club and be like, hey, guess who's here? It's me. Put me on stage. Like a Chris Rock can do that, but I cannot do that. And then... it's interesting, and it's a very humbling experience to be like, oh, I've worked for 17 years, and my cachet in a certain community is zero, and I have to start at the bottom and work my way up.
For you, it seems like it wouldn't bother you.
It doesn't. It's a real challenge, and it's a real mental bit of hurdles to get through, because every step of the way is an easy exit. Every step of the way is, you know what? I'm almost 50. This is a little ridiculous.
First night when you go back to ASCAT, how does the show go? How do you feel you did?
I feel I did well. I was responsible for a number of the other players getting big laughs. I was... just team player-y. I got some big laughs myself. There was no... It was also definitely a stand back and watch sort of...
As the train goes by?
Well, because it's also I'm not a complete student of the ASCAT form as it is these days.
Right.
So I had to sit back there and just watch. And if I felt there was a moment that I wasn't going to interfere with whatever the mojo was, but I could still step in and do something, I would do that. And I think that style helped the people who were the regulars just go, oh, this guy, he's not a threat, he's not a danger, he's not a loose cannon, he's not a volatile guy who could take a scene and ruin it.
But for you, it doesn't matter if you did well or not. You were still going to show up the next Sunday.
Yes, because I am determined to re-enter that world because I enjoy it so much. And, my two options are, say farewell to it and watch TV on Sunday night, or reintroduce myself to it and commit myself to it and work hard at it and enjoy it.
What do you enjoy about it now? It's almost 50.
I don't feel 50. First of all, my age, I will say this, for the maybe first three ASCATs, was constantly in my head, because they introduce you. It's a unique improv show because they're like, and we got this person and this person, and you run out there. And I always felt bad for the audience, when they'd call my name and here comes
here comes the old guy,
in his wheelchair,
right?
And I always I was self-conscious of that, but I knew that would go away in time, and it has. Like, so I've lost that hurdle or, you know, wall in my head. What was the question? Like, how?
I don't even remember.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's...
Oh, what do you enjoy about doing it at your age, at our age?
And I said, like, I really, like, age no longer plays a part. It's still the most fun someone of my mental type can have. Like, the biggest laughs I've ever had are either watching improv or being in improv.
And you'll say that more than doing stand-up for you.
Yeah, I mean, stand-up, you can record and show to someone and be like, see, that was funny, and they can say that. But improv doesn't always pass that test. You can't record an improv show and play it back for someone who wasn't there.
It doesn't hold up, usually.
It doesn't hold up at all. But those are the funniest moments I have. Like, in this past year of doing improv again, and just specifically improv again, I have laughed harder than I have in the past, like, 17 years. It's really an enjoyable art form.
Now, you said something to me, and I hope I can get there in my life. You said, this year, you're the happiest.
Right.
Can you explain that?
Because I'm truly doing... This year, I've committed to just putting together a show for myself. I know I'm taking a giant financial hit and perhaps committing career suicide by making myself obsolete. Because, like, if this show doesn't go well, if this show doesn't pan out or lead to any other opportunities, then I'm just a year older trying to be on a staff writing for someone.
So you will not take any staff writing job? You will not?
This year I have.
This year. You've been offered stuff, right?
Yes, yes.
And you've turned them down?
Yes.
For this project?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's the most enjoyable year I've had. Like, most... I feel I'm really being true to myself. I feel I'm... since I'm only writing for me, I'm able to put anything out there I want, and it's great because I'm learning, like I will have an idea for a bit, and I'll be like, that's hilarious, and I'll go out there, and it's not hilarious, or it's offensive, and I'll be like, oh, that's interesting, because working for Conan, he would have cut that bit before I ever got a chance to do it, and I would have resented that, and I would have been like, man, he doesn't know, because that bit's funny. And it turns out it's not funny. You know, it's like, it's an interesting lesson. But I'm doing everything just for myself. I think it's the same thing, like, when people say they're in business for themselves. Like, if you're a contractor, if you're working for a guy and you have to build a bathroom, that's one thing. But if you're the guy who owns the company and you're building a bathroom, it's a totally different, like, thrill and, you know, high or whatever. And that's what this year is for me. I set money aside for this year. Like,
you were always good with money. Always good. Don't you think?
That's from my mother. Okay. But I budgeted this year, and, okay, and I'm sticking to it. And it's just like, you know, I'm 8 months into the year now, and I'm premiering this show officially at the New York Comedy Festival in November. And that was the goal in January. And I'm getting there. And it's fun to watch yourself see a goal and set that goal and work for that goal and face every possible hurdle and want to quit every step along the way and just stick to it because I gave myself no other options.
Here's the thing that I have problems with goals, and I want to know if you can help me. I set a goal and I don't reach it, and then I quit. I'm sure that's happened to you before.
Yes.
What do you do in a situation like that?
So you set a goal, you don't reach it.
You don't reach it. I want to get to Aspen Comedy Festival. I remember doing a show. I was very close. First, second auditions, went out to L.A. To audition again. It didn't happen. It's like, oh, fuck it, I'm quitting. I don't see something like that happening with you.
It does, though. I put together a one-man show for a character, Raisin, to get to Montreal.
Raisin was the...
Folk singer.
Folk singer, yeah. And was that a character that you'd started out doing here?
Based? Yeah, I started in Chicago, brought it to Conan, and then did a one-man show in New York, which was critically well-received. It didn't translate well to the common man. But I didn't get into Montreal with that.
And that was your goal?
And that was my goal. And that was the end of that for me. Like, I didn't stubbornly stick and, like, try to force raisin down everybody's throat kind of thing. That, I sort of, like, that when I did not get Montreal, I was like, all right, you know, raisin's done for a while. But I had other stuff, like, I was still working at Conan, so I was able to just, like, just gonna throw 100% of my psychological energy back into my job. So I certainly, like, there's a point with everything where you have to acknowledge it's over. But if you really believe in something, like this show that I'm working on this year, there have been nights where I've done versions of it where it's just tanked and it's just sat there.
And this is an hour show.
This is
so if you're not tanking for 10 minutes, it's a long freaking hour.
It's a real tank job.
Right, right.
It's a real, like, there's sweat and yeah. The whole thing. But I believe in this show, and I know on those nights, or I knew on those nights, well, this, what they're seeing, what is failing is not the show that's in my head. I still haven't quite coalesced that show that's in my head. The one I'm doing in Chicago, like, I feel so confident about what is happening now, like, but it's hard work, like, but I saw, like, what this show was supposed to be back in January, but it's hard work to shape that clay.
Right.
But when that clay wasn't shaped in June, I knew, like, oh no, there's still molding to take place. With Raisin, I gave it my best shot, and I'm like, but I was also doing that myself. I didn't have a director. I learned a very important lesson, which was getting back to working with someone. I was like, I can't do this alone. I need people to work with me on this. And so that's the difference with this show, is it really...
How did you learn that lesson? Through Raisin?
Well, through Raisin and, like, what we talked about earlier, just, like, writing alone and being, like, the solo guy. Like, I really did learn that lesson of, like, no, it's my set of eyes are not the only set of eyes. My set of eyes are a limiting set of eyes, and why not invite more people in to observe and to weigh in and to suggest?
Well, and I think people are afraid if they do that, especially in solo work, that they're going to lose their voice.
Absolutely not the case.
How do you hold on to your voice working with the director?
Well, your voice is, like, your voice is your ultimate goal. Your, like, this show, like, I just wanted to be, like, this, like, weird, casual, like, fun variety show sort of atmosphere. And if it was just me doing it, it would have delved into so many weird tracks. But, like, a director can understand my goal, and it isn't in my head, so he's able to just stay true to what that goal is. And, like, so if I introduce, like, what if I do this and this, and he'll be like, no, because, like, what we're trying to get to is just here. So if you're going to go into route X, that's a complete diversion. You're contradicting your character from earlier. You may think it's funny, but it doesn't have a place in this set goal that we've set for ourselves. And that's the greatest value in the world. Like, that to me has cut years off of the trajectory of this show, like, getting to a tight place. You know, it's so helpful to have other eyes on it. Like, there's four people, more or less, that consistently are watching the development of this show, and I totally treasure...
Who are they?
Well, it's the director, it's my girlfriend, and then it's a couple... well, it's a stand-up that I work with in New York, and then it's another, like, improviser with UCB.
How important, because I know with my wife, there's been times where you're a bad actor, but she's also very supportive.
You say that to her?
She's said that to me when we've run lines.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. How important is Ruth's feedback in it?
It's good. I always tell Ruth, like, if I ask you for your feedback, then I want your feedback. I try, because you know, many people love to just give feedback.
Right. And but I get it. Yeah.
And so, like, we've come to over the years, because I value her opinion on almost everything. She has shaped my psychological well-being more than anybody. However, I only want her feedback, like, when I ask for it. Because usually, like, if something goes wrong, you know full well why it went wrong.
Right.
And you don't need someone to be like, you know, you forgot your line.
Right.
And you're like, yeah, I know. And so, like, but if it's a larger concept, or if it's a flow issue, and then I ask her about it, well, she will have 100 opinions on it, and they're valuable, and they're informed, and they're not just knee-jerk reactions.
Yeah, and I find that it's good to wait, like right after the show.
Oh,
especially
yeah.
if it's a bad show. I've had a couple times with my wife Lauren where it's like, no, I don't want to hear this right now.
Right,
you know, because you're absolutely. like when you come off a performance, it's like there's a lot of adrenaline. You're vulnerable.
Oh,
you know,
especially if it didn't go well.
Oh,
you are so vulnerable.
Right, and you don't want to hear 10 things you could have done because in your head you've got 30. You know,
right.
I didn't think of it.
You just want to get out.
Right.
You just want no one to see
right.
you.
Well, for me, I just want to, you know, hopefully not kill myself. You know.
Okay.
Have you ever had that, like, such a bad show you wanted to kill yourself, or is that just me?
Well, I hope it's neither one of us.
Okay, great. We've got to wrap this up, but one more thing before we go. Anyone who
First of all, can I congratulate anyone who's made it this far? Listening?
Yes. Well, maybe we'll break this episode up, because this is pretty long, don't
yeah.
you think? What advice would you give somebody starting out today in improv, stand-up, comedy?
My advice would be to... The advice I give to most people, and I think it's true, is to, whether you want to do stand-up or not, whether you want to do improv or not, like if you're a writer, or if you consider yourself an improviser, and so those other worlds just don't appeal to you, I think you should force yourself to go up on those stages, especially like if you're an improviser, force yourself to go up and do stand-up and feel that failure and force yourself to rework the idea that failed and go up and do it again. And there's just no better learning experience than that forcing yourself to do it, failing, and then forcing yourself to do it again. Because the one thing you learn is those failures, no one cares about them except you, really. Like, no one remembers them. And if they do, they might even remember them as good, like, for whatever reason. But you just need to teach yourself that your ideas you believe in and they can be worked on. And you need that experience of failing so that you're not afraid of it anymore and you can almost revel in it. Like, there are some shows that get so bad, they're enjoyable. Like, have you ever had that experience?
Yeah.
Where it's just, you're done fighting to try to save it, and then it just becomes...
Well, it's almost freeing.
Yeah, it's freeing.
Because you have nothing on the line.
Yeah, it just becomes this absurd joy as you just steer that ship right into the rocks, just like a drunken sea captain kind of thing. Those are all great experiences, and they toughen you, and you need calluses. Like, unless you're one of these wonderful, delicate flower actors that just has this, you know, draw to you that captivates people.
But we know that doesn't exist.
Not for me.
No. But, I mean, of all the people that we saw, I would say Farley was the only one that and you've seen a lot more go on.
Yeah.
But to me, he was like, he was an exception.
Yeah.
Everybody else had to work their fucking ass off. Myers, Koechner, Tina Fey, Rachel, Andy.
And continues to have to. You have to work your ass off. You have to.
Brian McCann, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jimmy.
And there you have it. That's episode, are you ready? 100. And it's in the can. What an episode it was. And I love when Brian was talking about that golf outing, he was paired up with... those bullies, and they all had to pay $400 to golf with them. That is karma. I love that. I love that. I want to thank our guest, Brian McCann, and look for his show, Brian McCann's Leisure Hour, coming somewhere soon, so look for it. I don't know exactly when he's going to put it up on a regular basis, but he is a super funny guy, so check that out. I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher, and or Chloe Fitzpatrick for putting this episode together and making me sound so slick and so professional. I really appreciate that. If you want more information about me and my improv blog that'll make you an even better improviser, or my Artist Low Comedy classes, or anything about my teaching or my books or whatever, go to jimmycorain.com. Also, check us out at feralaudio.com. We are part of a wonderful podcast collective. I'm going to name drop here because I'm so insecure. Chelsea Peretti, Matt Dwyer, Steve Agee, Todd Berry, Dan Harmon. Those are some of the people that have podcasts on feralaudio.com. So go check that out. We're also taking over social media. We have been for a while now. It's the first time I'm going to let you know that. We're on Facebook, so go to Improv Nerd and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. We're also on this thing called Twitter, so go to Improv_Nerd and follow us on Twitter. And we also have a wonderful YouTube channel, so if you want to see some of the clips instead of just hearing some of our guests and what they have to say, go find our YouTube channel. I want to thank you especially for listening, and these last 3 years, or close to 3 years, in September it'll be 3 years, and 100 episodes, and all the nice emails that you've sent me, and when I go to do workshops, you want to take a picture with me, which makes me feel, even though I look uncomfortable in the picture, I really, really appreciate it. So until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
A nerd, oh yeah, Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah, Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban, and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans, and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air, and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype, and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.